Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn and you're listening to episode number 71 of the Leading Wild Grain podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode of the podcast, my guest is Jean Crumley. Jean is the Director of Leadership Development for the University of California Davis School of Medicine. And we talk about how he got started in leadership development and what it means to live a life of purpose. So, listen up. Right before we jump into the conversation with Jean Crumley, I want to thank each and every one of you for your support of the Leading Wild Grain podcast. We've had an amazing year with some amazing guests, and your support of the podcast, your reviews on iTunes, your shares on social media, the emails that I've received from you has been tremendous. And I want to encourage you to keep going. I want to encourage you to keep it up. The more reviews we get on iTunes, the better the algorithm treats us. The more you share on social media, the more people listen, and you can be a part of this movement of taking this message of what it means to be an effective leader around the world. So I want to thank you for all that you have done, all that you are doing, and all that you will continue to do for the Leading Wild Grain podcast. My guest today is Jean Crumley, Director of Leadership Development for the University of California Davis School of Medicine. And we talk about how Jean got to the University of California and his journey in helping people discover what life is really about. Now, typically when I interview podcast guests, we do a setup, we walk through a couple of what the questions will be, and we sort of guide the podcast from the beginning. But during that setup, Jean just started coming on real rich. So I didn't do a typical setup. I just hit record and let Jean go. This is a masterclass. I only threw about three or four questions in because I wanted Jean to really unpack everything he was sharing with us. And it's going to be a rich, rich masterclass on leadership development. So listen up to my conversation with Jean Crumley.
Well, a year and a half ago, I was working full-time at the University of California, Davis. And I was splitting. So my appointment, my academic appointment is in the School of Medicine. But for 7 years, I actually had a split up. Well, the School of Medicine sold half of my time to the School of Veterinary Medicine at UC Davis.
Okay.
And that was, I really enjoyed those 7 years because the experience, even though I had the same title at both schools, Director of Leadership Development, I had very different assignments at the two schools. So at the School of Medicine, I have always and pretty much only interacted with faculty. So I teach faculty members courses under that broad heading of leadership. So communication and leadership styles and problem solving and just all, kind of things that would come under that very broad and amorphous heading of leadership. Mm-hmm. And that's been great. And I still really enjoy that work. I mean, that's why when I retired and the dean asked me to stay on part-time, I quickly agreed because it's very satisfying work. The faculty there at the medical school, they're bright. We've got a pretty diverse group of faculty at the medical school. Just like our students are a very diverse group, and I get to, in addition to teach courses, I do individual one-on-one, what we call coaching, with people in various leadership roles, department chairs, division chiefs, residency and fellowship directors, things like that. So that's been great, and I really really enjoy it, and And again, that's why it was an easy decision to agree to come back part-time. But the 7 years at the veterinary school was really enjoyable as well, because I got to spend a pretty good chunk of my time working with students. I ran a leadership program for veterinary students for several years that I really enjoyed, because I met them in their first semester of their first year. This was a selective program, so it was not open to all the incoming first-year students. Mm. But they stayed with me in a cohort, and we met two Saturdays a semester, 6 hours each Saturday, over five semesters. So their first 2.5 years of their four-year doctoral program. And it was just so satisfying to watch them mature in their thinking about leadership from that very first semester when many, not all, but many of them were right out of college. So they're in their, you know, kind of their early to mid-20s. And then by the time they get into that first semester of their third year, they're into the mid, some of them into their late 20s. And even just those 2.5 years, you can watch their thinking really mature and to move from that idea of, you know, how tough could leadership be, to, oh my gosh, this is really complex. And and that kind of humility, watching them develop their humility, was just enormously satisfying. And then, of course, I gave talks at the veterinary school, and I did work with faculty, but it was very different, the two schools, and I found that enormously satisfying.
So how did you end up with this job? I mean, director of leadership development at a very prestigious university. How did you get there? How did you land there?
Yeah, luck over skill. Luck over skill. One of the very first questions I pose to those veterinary students the very first Saturday that we spend together, I outline for them an idea that Chris, I think his first name is Chris Christensen at Harvard Business School, talks about, and he distinguishes between a planned life and a summoned life. And mm-hmm. I don't characterize it in religious terms, but the idea for someone like you and myself who come through religious training, the idea of being called is, you know, a really important idea. So the idea of a summoning, if you will, a summoned life, is not completely antagonistic or completely opposite of a planned life. But I characterize it this way to the students. I say a planned life is one where you decide where you want to be, and then you reverse engineer it, and you map out all the steps necessary to get there. I said a summoned life, the metaphor I'd like you to kind of visualize, is that you're standing on one side of a body of water. It could be a river, it could be a lake, it doesn't matter. And there are stones, rocks, sticking above the water all the way across. And a planned life would be to stand on the one side of that body of water, see exactly where you wanted to get on the other side, and then visually map out how you're going to get there. I said a summoned life, on the other hand, would have a goal of getting to the other side, but would not be tightly fixed on a particular location. I mean, you'd have a general sense of where you wanted to get on the other side, but not a specific and particular location. And what you would do is you would get a sense of how you would move from where you are to that general place of where you want to be. But instead of mapping out every single step that you would take a few steps, you'd get out onto the water, and you'd stop, and you'd reflect, and you'd reevaluate, and you'd make adjustments accordingly to your plan, if you will. So I say, okay, so that's the difference between a planned life and a summon life. How many of you have a planned life? Every hand goes up. Every hand shoots up like a cork out of water. And then 2.5 years later, when they're at the beginning of their third year, and in their third year, they begin to see patients. Now, in veterinary medicine, the patient is the animal, and the responsible party is referred to as the client. So in the third year, they start to see patients, and they start to interact with the public. So then I ask them, I say, do you remember that first question I posed to you 2.5 years ago about a planned and summon life? Now, I'm going to remind you that all of you raised your hands for a planned life 2.5 years ago. How many of you are still with that? And very few hands go up. And I said, so can I assume from that you're in the category of a summoned life? And then all the hands that, except for those one or two that went up with plan, now shoot up. And I said, okay, so what's happened? And they typically don't know how to answer that question. So it's somewhat rhetorical on my part. And I say, well, how about this idea? You're not the same person that you were 2.5 years ago. Now, there's continuity. It's not, you know, a Jekyll and Hyde kind of, oh my gosh, I don't recognize who's in the mirror, but you're not the same person. And it's that very ancient idea that Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, said that we never put our foot in the same river twice. And I said, that's the goal in leadership, just like in the goal in life, to evolve, to become a person who sees the world differently as you age, as you mature. And then I typically at that point tell them the quote from Marcel Proust and I don't have it committed to memory, so I'll butcher it at this point. But the idea that the greatest voyage in life is not to travel to new lands, but to see with new eyes. And I tell them that's what leadership is largely about, is being able to look at things differently from multiple points of view. And that's a sign of real maturity as a human being and as a leader. Because we talk about for those 2.5 years, the challenge in any kind of scientific profession like veterinary medicine of confirmation bias, that we believe something to be true or not, and all the evidence to support our idea comes flooding in. And I said, what good leaders do is they recognize their own biases, and then they work extra hard to look for evidence to indicate that they're wrong, that that's not the only way to see. I remember a conversation I had several years ago now with one of the leaders at the medical school, and I remember saying to him, the real goal in leadership is not to ask the question, what do I know? But the real important question is to ask, what don't I know? Because I said, the universe of what we don't know is vastly larger than the universe of what we do know. And there's this false notion in science that the known universe remains constant, and so the more we learn, the less there in fact is to learn. And I said, but the science, good science, is just the opposite of that. That every question that gets answered in good science poses three more. And I said, so the image of our knowledge, both our knowledge and our ignorance, is like that of a balloon. So even as the balloon interior gets larger, the perimeter of the balloon also gets larger, and that universe becomes even larger still. So, and when, you know, that's a pretty sophisticated concept for a 21, 22 year old, but by the time they're 23, 24, they're beginning to get it. And it's I found it to be a very helpful concept with adult leaders in medicine. But Pierre, the real question, or the real answer to the question, how did I get where I am today? It's because I got to an airport in 1995 with only 3/4 in my pocket instead of the typical 4. So what had happened in 1995 is my wife and I and our 2 kids moved from Georgia, where I'd been working with Habitat for Humanity for 13 years, to California. But I continued working with Habitat, principally in Georgia and Florida, although in pretty much the Eastern Seaboard. And what I would do is my wife would drop me off at the airport, and this is pre-9/11, so this is when you really could do that O.J. Simpson running through the terminal to catch your plane. She would drop me off on a Sunday. I'd have 4 quarters in my pocket because I could buy a New York Times with 4 quarters, and I would be able to read it from Sacramento to Dallas-Fort Worth, and then from Dallas-Fort Worth either to Miami or Atlanta. And one Sunday, for whatever reason, she dropped me off, and I only had 3 quarters in my pocket, and I could only buy a Wall Street Journal, and I didn't read the Wall Street Journal. So I was, I thought that's the enemy's paper. But that's all I had was 75 cents, so I bought a Wall Street Journal. And by the time we got ready to land at Dallas-Fort Worth, I had, read everything I was interested in. I folded it over and stuck it in the back pocket of the seat in front of me. And I noticed a University of California Davis seal, the logo. And I thought, I wonder what that is. And I just stuck it in my briefcase. And then a couple days later, I pulled it out of my briefcase. And I noticed it was a job advertisement for the university. I went ahead and applied for the job, for which I really wasn't qualified. But I got to the final round of interviews, and the dean at the college where I was applying said to me, he said, "You don't really have experience in this area, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." And, but I never said I did. I said, "But here's what I have done, and I think it translates." And so he was very polite. And then a few days later, I got a letter from him saying, "You know, thanks. Have a nice life. But we made the offer to someone else." But interestingly, he had handwritten a little note below that said, "Stay in touch." But I interpret it as kind of a throwaway line. Mm-hmm. But a few weeks later, and I was back in Georgia at this time, or actually I was in Florida at this time, because this was after the that big earthquake, that big hurricane in South Florida in 1992, Hurricane Andrew. I think it was 92. Habitat had gotten some great press because all of our little houses there had withstood that hurricane, where a lot of very expensive houses hadn't. So I was head of fundraising at the time. So I raised a lot of money for Florida, and I was going back and forth from Georgia to Florida just to make sure that the money was well spent and things like that. So I was in Homestead, Florida, when I got a phone call from the dean's secretary, and she asked me when I was going to next be back in California. And I told her, and she said, "Well, the dean would like to meet with you then." And I said, "Yeah, that, you know, it's fine." And anyway, long story short, I met with him, and he said, "Look, if you're interested, we've created a job because we'd like you to work for us. You were not the right fit for the job you actually applied for, but are you interested?" So I said, "Yeah," I took the job, and that's how I ended up at the University of California. It is my alma mater. That's why or UC Davis is my alma mater. That's why I took a look at the seal. If it said UC Berkeley or UC anywhere else but Davis, I probably would never have even looked. So 25 cents is how I got or the lack of 25 cents is how I got here.
Wow. Three quarters later.
Yeah. And it's been one of those, you know, summoned life kind of opportunities. I had planned to, when I met my wife, who was at the time my girlfriend in 1977, I had actually planned on finishing up my bachelor's degree and then enrolling in a PhD program in literature. And that was coming at the end of, it took me 9 years to get a 4-year degree, because after my sophomore year, I decided I really didn't want to become a doctor, which had been my original plan. And then I didn't know what to do. So I did what was at the time, and I still think was the smartest thing I could do. I dropped out of school for 5 years and went surfing. and by the time I was, I've been 24, 7 years out of high school, then I was ready to go back to school. So that was my plan. And then I met my wife, or the woman who would become my wife. Within 3 days after meeting her, I called my grandmother in San Diego, because she had told me when I met the girl she told me, "When you meet the right girl, you'll know it." And I said, yeah, that happens in the movies, not in real life. So I called her and said, "You know what? You're right." So we got engaged and married, and her dad was a minister in the United Church of Christ. And in him, I saw this wonderful embodiment of the two things that had been very attractive to me in terms of thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. One being medicine, which is really about helping people. And then involved in writing and thinking and speaking, which is what a minister does on Sunday mornings. So I abandoned the idea of getting a doctoral degree in literature and went to divinity school. And then after 3 years of divinity school, I only lasted full time in that occupation for 2 years. It's because I had met in my senior year a guy named Millard Fuller, who this was 1981, who just 4 years earlier had started a group called Habitat for Humanity, but nobody had ever heard of it because that, I used to jokingly say it's because he started Habitat in 1977 BC, before the Carter. and then after Jimmy Moson and Carter got on board, then of course everybody began to hear about Habitat. And then did that for 13 years. So that was again sort of one of those summoned life things. I'd met him in my senior year, and was just absolutely taken with the idea of what I thought was a really practical way of helping people. And Jimmy Carter had a really nice phrase. He said, "Habitat gives people a hand up, not a handout." Mm-hmm. And I remember after meeting Millard in my senior year, and this was after I'd accepted a call to First Presbyterian Church in Corvallis, Oregon. I went home and read his book that he had sold during this little speaking engagement at the seminary. There's only four or five of us who attended. And then waking my wife up at, you know, like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, I said, "Oh my gosh, I just met this guy, Millard Fuller, and we've got to go to Georgia and help him. He's onto something really important." And I remember saying to me, "Yeah, that's nice, sweetheart. Why don't you think about actually, since you've promised the people in Corvallis, Oregon, that you'll accept their call, why don't you at least do that, since that's what you've been planning for 3 years?" Anyway, long story short, I invited Millard to come out to to the West Coast, San Francisco, Corvallis, where we were, Portland and Seattle. I arranged for him to speak in all those places. And he asked my wife and I, and at the time, 1-year-old son, to come back and help him with this ministry that he was starting. He said, "You know, I can't pay you because we don't have any money to pay anybody. But if you'd come back and help us for a little while, I'd really appreciate it." So that what was going to be 1 year of volunteering turned out to be 13 years. Now, I only volunteered the 1 year, then the 12 subsequent years, I actually did get a salary. That's kind of the arc of my professional life. It's been a summoned life.
Now, with your role now, in helping leaders, how have you seen, and I think this really ties into this idea of the summoned life, have you seen each of those past experiences come to bear and really undergird what you're doing now in leadership development?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell you a story that I think really nicely illustrates this. So I did a retreat for our Department of Surgery. And afterwards, the division chief and the vice chair of the department, he's the division chief for trauma surgery and the vice chair for the Department of Surgery, very bright guy, had young at the time, in his late 30s, I think. And he had come through the Navy. And he'd risen to the rank of, I believe, captain. So he had really moved rapidly through the ranks as an officer, as a surgeon. That's what the Navy had him do was work. But he moved through the ranks, and so he said to me, "You know, I know you do coaching. Can we meet?" And I said, "Sure." So we met the first time, and you could see on the wall of his office all of these awards that he's had achieved, and all of the various degrees and And we talked about his time in the Navy and all of the training that the military and Navy included offers to people. And so, you know, we got to the end of that first time, and I said to him, so tell me what you want to accomplish in your role as vice chair and division chief. And so he laid out, you know, a very articulate plan and how he planned to get there and things like that. So I listened carefully. And at that point, I said, if you're open to this idea, I'd like to talk with you about the difference between a planned life and a summoned life. And so we did, and I could tell he was really interested and very skeptical. So as time went by, and we've been meeting now for several years, it has just been fascinating to watch his evolution and his thinking away from a planned life to a summoned life. And I remember sitting in his office, and this is probably within the last year and a half or two, and him saying to me, "This is really hard." And I said, "Yeah, it's hard." And I said, and part of the reason it's hard is, and why it's hard for someone like you who has accomplished so much in your life, is that you know how rewarding a planned life can be." Mm-hmm. He said, "Yes, and I just can't shake this idea of a summoned life, because I said, "Yeah, but here's the trade-off, is that a planned life, you can definitely tick off the accomplishments, and the frustrations you will experience is anything that becomes an impediment to your plan." I said, "In a summoned life, it's not as though it's a stress-free or easy way to live." I said to him, "I think in some ways it's actually a harder way to live, because you have to be constantly questioning yourself and your thinking. And at the same time, you've got to maintain this sort of intellectual and emotional openness to the universe." He's not a religious person, but everybody who I spend any time with, and most of them know ahead of time, you know, what my background is. Mm-hmm. And I explained to them, "You have to understand that the metaphors, the lenses through which I look in my my formative education, just like you look through the lens of medicine, I look through the lens of theology, I said, one of the great challenges with a summoned life is that you have to still that anxious voice inside of your head that wants to know where you're going and how to get there." Hmm. And I said, in a summoned life, the reason it's hard is you've got to be, in a certain sense, constantly disciplining your mind and your emotions to not let that voice get so loud that you can't hear that still small voice that's saying, "Take this route, not that route." Mm. I think about my own life, that's what I have found so satisfying here at the twilight of my professional career, is that without having that language, nonetheless, for the last 35 years, I've been able to, 37 years, I've been able to quiet that anxious voice that everybody has of wanting to, you know, control our lives and to try and listen to the universe and see where it might be prompting us to move. That that you can never have if you just plan and then reverse engineer everything you want to get to. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
Oh, it does. It does. And I see how you've woven your theological study into the framework of speaking to leaders where they are. Now, if you had to go back, mm-hmm. and this is the last question I'll ask you. If you had to go back and you had to maybe give some advice or chart a leadership development plan for like the 25-year-old you, 30-year-old you, based on what you've known now and coaching college students and adults for the past several decades, what would you go back? If you could press a button, what would you go back and tell yourself?
Yeah. I would say that the most important quality or characteristic that you need to protect with absolute vigilance is your curiosity about yourself and about the world. And this is where I lucked out, as did you, by going to seminary, because without probably being explicitly told, I don't know if you were, I was not explicitly told to guard my reputation, but everything I learned in those years of graduate education signaled that idea of guarding your reputation, mm-hmm. And of taking at times the hard path instead of the easy path, because the hard path was the right path. There was an incredible story that I read years ago now, decades ago, about I think it was Henry Ward Beecher. I can't remember for sure now his name, but he was a very famous preacher at Riverside Church in New York, and he had, he was just incredibly popular, and presidents of the United States would come and sit in his congregation when they were in New York, and had enormous influence. But this story that Frederick Buechner was telling about him was that one day he was shaving, and he was thinking about this woman that he was having an affair with, and he nicked himself when he was shaving. And I remember, and I can't remember exactly how Frederick Buechner you know, used that illustration to make whatever point he was trying to make in that essay that I was reading. But I remember that image just so cemented itself in my thinking that I don't ever want to do something that when I look at myself in the mirror, I'll be embarrassed or I'll be ashamed. Or that doesn't mean I've never made mistakes. I've made mistakes, mistakes aplenty, but not the kinds of mistakes that would damage my reputation. Because I learned very early on how important it was to apologize when you make mistakes, to genuinely and sincerely apologize. But that if you make mistakes because of judgment around complex problems as opposed to ethical problems, people will forgive you. I mean, I remember telling my students and myself, and this would also be part of that advice to the 25-year-old version of me, don't become hypocritical. Because people will forgive leaders for every kind of mistake they make except hypocrisy. And I've tried to practice that now for 37 years, and I've tried to teach it for the almost 22 plus years I've been at the university.
My guest today on the Leading While Green podcast has been the semi-retired director of leadership development, the School of Medicine at UC Davis, Gene Crumley. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. I appreciate your insights, and I know our audience is going to be better for it.
Thank you, Pierre. I appreciate it.
Great conversation with Gene Crumley on distinguishing the difference between a planned life and a summoned life. Really, really rich interview, and I hope you took good notes. Just want to remind you to hop over to prcquinn.com and check out my free course, 12 Ways to Grow as a Leader, my free course to help you transition from 2018 to 2019. Also, check out my signature leadership course, the Leading While Green Leadership Course, packed with tons of high quality video content, actionable, practical advice that you can implement to grow your leadership and grow your leadership team. A review on iTunes wouldn't be a bad idea either. Hop over to iTunes and leave a 5-star review and some comments. Let somebody else know about how much you enjoy this podcast. And as we come down to the end of the year, I hope this has made a difference in the places where you live, work, and play. That's all I got for this episode. So until next time, take care and God bless.